it is not sufficient simply for a company to say that they're prepared to operate in Alaska.
Environmental groups react to a Coast Guard report on the grounding of Shell's Kulik drill rig. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, April 3rd. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, lawmakers prepare for a marathon session on education funding.
It's going to be a long one. I think that's probably going to be one of the longest bills that we probably take up on the floor this year.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, proud supporter of APRN and dedicated to helping people reach their goals on and off the field. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com.
The Coast Guard has released the results of an investigation into the grounding of Shell's Kulik drill rig at the end of their troubled Arctic drilling season. The agency found that Royal Dutch Shell and its subcontractor, Edison Shoe West, severely underestimated the risk of towing an unpropelled oil rig through the Gulf of Alaska in a winter storm in December 2012. The Kulik had been moored at a custom-built dock in Dutch Harbor. According to the Coast Guard, Shell executives believed they could dodge a multi-million dollar state tax bill if they moved the rig out of Alaska before the start of the new year. Some mariners knew it would be a rough journey. In an email before the trip, the master of the Ivik tow vessel said a winter tow, quote, guarantees an ass-kicking, end quote. As predicted, the fleet encountered rough seas. The tow line between the Kulik and its tow vessels snapped repeatedly, in part due to inadequate equipment. After multiple attempts to recover the rig, the Kulik crashed into a remote island on New Year's Eve 2012. It took days to recover the vessel. The accident reportedly cost Shell more than $90 million. And it gave critics of Arctic oil exploration plenty of ammunition. Michael Levine is the Pacific Senior Counsel for Oceana.
We need to fundamentally rethink the way we're balancing costs and benefits and the standards to which we're holding companies like Shell.
The Coast Guard uncovered multiple legal violations in their investigation, including failures to report marine casualties and safety issues. The agency also discovered inadequate watchkeeping in the bridge and engine rooms of Shell's fleet. Levine says the federal government bears some blame since they approved Shell's Arctic exploration plans.
It is not sufficient simply for a company to say that they're prepared to operate in Alaska. We all deserve to have these companies come here and show us that they actually appreciate the difficulty and remoteness of operating in Alaska waters and the importance of those resources to all of us.
The Coast Guard is recommending measures to improve tow plans and correct engineering deficiencies on the Ivik tug. In a statement, Shell spokeswoman Megan Baldino said the company is taking the Coast Guard's findings seriously. Quote, already we have implemented lessons learned from our internal review of our 2012 operations. Those improvements will be measured against the findings in the USCG report, as well as recommendations from the U.S. Department of Interior, end quote. Interior Secretary Sally Jewell already rejected a plan to build a road through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge to link King Cove to the all-weather airport at Cold Bay. All three members of Alaska's congressional delegation are trying to get her to change her mind. Today, as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, it was Congressman Don Young's turn to press the case.
As a member of the House Natural Resources Committee, Young was allotted 5 minutes to question Jewell on the president's $12 billion budget for Interior. Young asked only about King Cove. And Young wasn't taking no for an answer. In fact, at times, he wasn't taking any answers. Young insisted the birds of the Eisenbeck Refuge would adjust to traffic, like the birds on the George Washington Parkway along the Potomac. Jewell told him the Eisenbeck is a wetland of global significance.
The birds that are in that area are different than the birds in the Potomac River. And,
there are no different. They're the same type of bird, same species as far as genetically goes, and you and I know that.
No, sir, the Pacific Black Ranch
is exactly the same attitude. They get used to it.
When bad weather prevents normal air travel in King Cove, critically ill and injured people have to wait for a Coast Guard helicopter. Such rescues generally happen 4 or 5 times a year, although there have been 5 just since December, and they're said to cost more than $200,000 apiece. Young threatened Jewel with an unpleasant choice. Which of her divisions should Congress deduct that cost from?
Which one of those departments do you think we should take it out of?
Congressman, I will continue to be...
Which one of the departments should we take it out of?
Congressman, I do not believe that money
for a
medical...
You don't think it'll happen,
can I finish? Would you like me to answer the question?
No, I want to ask you which department. You answer.
Jewel also had to defend her King Cove decision last week at a Senate hearing, although Senators Lisa Murkowski and Mark Begich were less forceful in style. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
After a research review, the National Marine Fisheries Service is prepared to loosen controversial limits on fishing in the western Aleutian Islands. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal has more.
The National Marine Fisheries Service, or NMFS, closed fishing grounds 3 years ago to protect an endangered population of Steller sea lions. That triggered several rounds of litigation and a new evaluation of the science behind fishing bans. Brandi Gerke is a NMFS resource management specialist. She helped the agency write its new biological opinion on whether increased fishing would harm sea lions.
We don't have any direct scientific evidence that fisheries are causing nutritional stress in Steller sea lions.
That conclusion has cleared NMFS to open more fishing grounds in the Western Aleutians, according to a plan that was approved by the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. Gerke says that biologists still have lingering concerns about how to harvest fish safely in critical habitat areas without disturbing Steller sea lions.
So NMFS is still recommending that the fishery be dispersed over a greater amount of time, so not going in and catching fish all in a very concentrated fashion.
Those recommendations will be included in a proposed rule from NMFS. They'll take public comments on those new regulations, but if they're finalized, fishermen will have access to previously forbidden stocks of Atka mackerel, Pacific cod, and pollock as early as next year. Michael Levine says that's pretty sudden. Levine is a lawyer for Oceana, an environmental group that's been fighting for years to uphold fishing bans in the Western Aleutians.
The controversy is about whether removing 60% of the fish that used to be there is contributing to the continuing decline of the species and its overall failure to recover. Historically, the agency has said that it has, and this new analysis reflects a step back from that very well scientifically justified position.
Levine wouldn't comment on whether Oceana might sue to keep the fishing grounds closed. At least one group applauded the decision to loosen restrictions. The Aleut Corporation holds a small amount of pollock quota in the Western Aleutian Islands. It's supposed to bring business to ADAC, but the share is in an area that was closed to fishing until now. In a statement, the Aleut Corporation said it's grateful for any new fishing opportunities that will come as a result of the federal study, for ADAC and for other communities throughout the Aleutian chain. In On Alaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, budget cuts forced the state to pull staff from the Round Island Walrus Sanctuary.
Next year, we will not have a program out there at all at this point in time.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Salmon aren't just another fish in Alaska. They're our lifeblood, a source of food, rich tradition, jobs, businesses, and community. They're as resilient as Alaskans themselves and as creative and resourceful, too. At salmonlove.com, you'll find a site dedicated to Alaskans' connection with our state's most famed fish. Enjoy stories, tips, fun, and lots of other salmon-y goodness, too. Salmonlove.com. This message brought to you by the Salmon Project.
Tomorrow, state representatives will vote on a sprawling education bill that deals with everything from school budgets to teacher tenure to the establishment of charter schools. Some lawmakers, like Anchorage Democrat Chris Tuck, are already preparing for a marathon session.
It's going to be a long one. I think that's probably going to be one of the longest bills that we probably take up on the floor this year.
APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports that some of the biggest fights are expected to center around the education funding formula.
On Wednesday, it took the House Finance Committee about 6 hours to work through more than 20 amendments that members wanted to make to the legislation. There were split votes, a good bit of sniping, and multiple apologies before the group finally moved the bill out of committee that evening. The process is not expected to be any easier once the bill hits the floor. At a press conference on Thursday, the Democratic minority explained that their major concern is that an increase to the base student allocation, the amount of money a school gets per student enrolled, does not go far enough. Here's Representative Les Guerra of Anchorage.
We faced 3 years of cuts in the past. This extends 3 more years of cuts. Cuts this coming year, and then bigger cuts the following 2 years when the base student allocation gets smaller.
The House Finance version of the bill spends an extra $225 million on per-pupil funding over the course of 3 years. But some of that could cancel out because of a loss of $25 million in one-time funding. Governor Sean Parnell's proposal adds just over $100 million to that pot of money over the same period of time. Representative David Guttenberg of Fairbanks says neither of those figures are enough to prevent layoffs in the state's biggest school districts.
I think, you know, if you ask them if they take a poke in the eye or a kick in the backside, they'll take whatever they can get over nothing.
The Democrats' proposal costs about $450 million over 3 years. But Republicans in the majority are concerned that a bigger increase than what they are offering could put serious pressure on future budgets. Representative Mia Costello of Anchorage told reporters on Thursday that education is being treated as an exception as other state agencies are being told to keep their budgets flat.
We are still prioritizing education while the rest of state government we are cutting. We've been cutting operating budget of state government so that we can continue to fund education increases.
Costello also argued that their proposal gives an extra boost to urban schools, where 80% of Alaska students are enrolled. The House Finance Committee did this by adjusting the education funding formula to weigh the state's larger schools more generously. The existing funding formula gives rural schools extra funds because costs in remote areas are higher. The House is expected to debate the bill at the same time a citizens group made of parents will be rallying for more education funding on the Capitol steps. In Juneau, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
How to address the teacher retirement debt is another friction point for lawmakers. Governor Sean Parnell says a House Finance Committee proposal to deal with the teachers' retirement system is immoral and shifts the debt obligation to future generations. Parnell wants the plan pulled from his education bill. The committee added the retirement plan to its rewrite of House Bill 278, but Parnell says they're two very separate issues. The bill is scheduled for the House floor tomorrow. Parnell has proposed putting $1.1 billion into the system and making annual payments of about $340 million over 20 years. Trust fund earnings would eventually be used to pay benefits. The committee plan proposes a $1.4 billion cash infusion and would start with smaller annual payments and payments stretched over a longer period. Legislative Finance Division Director David Teal says the approaches are just philosophically different. The plan to construct a toll bridge across Kinnick Arm advanced yesterday when the Senate Finance Committee voted in favor of sending it to the floor for consideration. Lawmakers heard testimony on the bridge from Kabata, the Department of Transportation, and the Department of Revenue. In committee, the bridge's sole opponent was Senator Donald Olson. He says if this project were to move forward in budget surplus years, he might be more willing to support it. But the current fiscal climate doesn't allow for the bridge.
What I see is we are flying at full throttle into a hurricane that's going to cause us a fiscal crisis. And this is another one of those nails in the coffin of financial responsibility.
Representative Mark Newman, a Republican from Big Lake who sponsored the bill, says the jobs and development created by the bridge could ease the impact of a state recession. According to the Department of Revenue, the worst-case scenario could see the state paying up to $450 million in bond repayment over 20 years should toll revenues fall short. The current financial plan will not proceed unless federal loans are obtained, in which case the issue would return to the legislature. Back in 1960, seven uninhabited Bristol Bay islands south of Togiak were incorporated into the Walrus Islands State Game Sanctuary. As the name suggests, the sanctuary protects one of the largest terrestrial haul-out sites of Pacific walruses in North America. The Department of Fish and Game's Wildlife Division decided last week that it will terminate its Round Island program, which staffs the sanctuary to monitor the marine mammals and host visitors. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
Since 1975, Fish and Game has staffed the sanctuary through the summer months, typically with two wildlife biologists who arrive on Round Island in early May and leave by late August. But citing substantial cuts to the budget of its wildlife division, the department announced this year the sanctuary will have more limited staff presence, and next year it looks like there will be none at all. Ed Weiss is the lands and refuge manager within the division and has been overseeing the Walrus Island Sanctuary since 2008.
Next year, we will not have a program out there at all at this point in time. The budget's been cut, so the department will have to evaluate how we'll be able to maybe check on things, whether that's regional staff stopping by or us coming out and doing a periodic check. But we will not have any staff permanently stationed on the island.
Wildlife Division Director Doug Vincent Lang says this is one of several programs that will be affected as the division tries to balance the books after absorbing a $450,000 budget cut from the state. He says visitation to Round Island has dwindled in recent years, down to less than 100 people in 2013. That's far less than the number who visit the state's McNeil River Sanctuary, which now requires a lottery to get permits. But Vincent Lang says this was not an easy choice, and the division is concerned about the protection of the Walrus Sanctuary and the abundant number of marine mammals that haul out there. Others were quick to say this is the latest example of the state's mismanaged budget priorities. Bob Shavelson is the executive director of Cook Inlet Keeper.
What we're seeing here is a series of regulatory rollbacks, a series of budgetary cutbacks that are eroding protections for our special areas that make Alaska unique.
Shavelson says the Walrus Island Sanctuary deserves protection, and if the state won't do it, then someone else should.
It's the only protected area for walruses in North America, and it was one of the first in Alaska. And when you take that away, you're really going to threaten that resource. Alaska always decries the heavy hand of federal overreach, but we're seeing time and time again that the state is incapable or unwilling to protect the resources that we have here.
Fish and Game's Vincent Lang says he's encouraged his staff to look outside the division to other groups and agencies for possible partnering to continue the program, which is housed at Round Island within the sanctuary. This year's two staff members are expected to arrive next month, but will only stay through early August. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. Enjoy a lunchtime talk with Dennis Hayes, CEO of the world's most energy-efficient commercial building, on Thursday, May 1st, during the 6th Annual Business of Clean Energy in Alaska Conference at the Dena'ina Center. Individual tickets for this keynote luncheon can be purchased at bceaconference.com or 929-7770. Clean energy, it's everyone's business. This message sponsored by REAP.
Alaska State Troopers say a Homer man fatally shot himself after he grabbed a trooper's gun during a struggle following a domestic violence call. KBBI's Aaron Selbig reports.
24-year-old Aaron Michael Rael Catholic is dead following the incident Wednesday night. According to a trooper report, an unidentified trooper attempted to apprehend Rael Catholic following a report of a domestic violence assault shortly after 8 p.m. at a residence about 4 miles out East End Road. The female victim who made the report was able to escape the assault by her ex-boyfriend, Rael Catholic. She left the residence in a vehicle just as the trooper arrived on the scene. Rael Catholic then used another vehicle to ram into the victim's car. According to the report, the suspect then got out of the car and a struggle ensued with the trooper. In an attempt to apprehend Rael Catholic, the trooper used pepper spray and then his taser, but to no avail. The trooper and the suspect ended up wrestling on the ground. During the struggle, Rael Catholic got a hold of the trooper's pistol and fatally shot himself. Trooper spokesperson Megan Peters said troopers could not release any further information about the incident until completion of an investigation by the Alaska Bureau of Investigation.
We're essentially handling it like it's a trooper-involved shooting.
Peters did confirm that the trooper was the only law enforcement officer who responded to the original call. She did not know if he called for backup during the incident. The female victim was taken to South Peninsula Hospital in Homer, but her condition was unknown. The trooper was not injured in the incident. Peters said his identity will not be released for 72 hours. Reporting from Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
The wife of a man who went missing during the 2012 Mount Marathon race is suing the Seward Chamber of Commerce. The wrongful death suit is asking for a judgment of $5 million. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
According to the complaint, Peggy LeMaitre alleges that the Seward Chamber of Commerce showed outrageous conduct, was negligent in its duty of care toward both the missing man, Michael LeMaitre, and herself. According to the suit, this breach of duty on the part of the defendant is a direct and proximate cause of Michael LeMaitre's death. The suit also alleges that Peggy LeMaitre suffered emotional distress in the manner of which she learned of her husband's disappearance. The Chamber of Commerce attorney, Laura Eakes, wants the suit dismissed. According to court documents, the chamber disputes Peggy LeMaitre's claim because the circumstances of Michael LeMaitre's presumed death have never been determined. The defendants also claim that there is no cause for the claim of negligence on the chamber's part and that Michael LeMaitre may have had a pre-existing physical condition prior to the race. Michael LeMaitre, aged 65 at the time, entered the men's Mount Marathon race in 2012. He was last seen approaching the summit of the mountain by race officials. His body was never found, despite intense efforts by local officials and Alaska State Troopers. The 3.5-mile race takes runners more than 3,000 feet up to the top of the mountain, then down again through rough terrain, rocky stream beds, and along dangerous drops. Since Michael LeMaitre's disappearance, race officials have altered some of the rules. Now, runners must meet time markers along segments of the race or be disqualified. An October court date has been set for the trial, but a trial venue is in dispute, with attorneys for the chamber opting for Seward and for the plaintiffs for Anchorage. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Yesterday, we reported that Accutan residents are pleased with their new airport taxi, a helicopter that came online in February. The Aleutians East Borough is already running out of money to pay for it. Today, in the second part of our series on the struggle to connect Accutan to its airport, the borough settles on a permanent solution. As KUCB's Annie Ropeek reports, it's one they rejected a decade ago.
Accutan's airport is unique in a lot of ways. For one, it's not on Accutan. It's 7 miles away on Akoon Island. That means airport operations are a little more complicated than normal, so they're divided up among three groups: the City of Accutan, the Aleutians East Borough, and the State of Alaska. One major task is getting people from Accutan to the airport. Sean Holland of the State Department of Transportation says that job falls to just one entity.
The Aleutians East Borough agreed to provide and fund the operation of the marine link between the City of Accutan and the island of Akoon.
The borough started exploring their options almost a decade ago. A boat seemed like the obvious choice, but they could also try a hovercraft or a helicopter, whatever was cheapest and most reliable. They hired a maritime engineering firm to figure that out. Gloston Associates said a hovercraft would be able to make the trip to the airport 90% of the time at a cost of just over $1 million a year. They said that made it cheaper and more efficient than a boat. That was in 2005, years before Borough Administrator Rick Gifford was hired. But he knows the history. Based on Gloston's work, Gifford says the borough was prepared to cover the $1 million annual cost.
It was kind of estimated that between charges for passengers and for freight, that they might be able to recoup up to $500,000 of that.
And he says they agreed to pay another $500,000 out of pocket. The borough was able to save money by recycling a hovercraft they'd already bought for King Cove. It stopped running there in 2010 after it proved too costly and unreliable. In March 2010, the state broke ground on the airport. Construction was going well for about a year, until the Aleutians East Borough hit a snag. At a meeting in 2011, the borough assembly recalculated how much money the hovercraft would bring in. Their estimates were a lot lower than what Gloston Associates had told them years before, and the assembly wasn't completely sure why. KUCB reached out to Gloston about the alleged discrepancies, and the firm wouldn't comment. Whatever the reason, the assembly was no longer sure if the hovercraft could work long term. So they had a choice: go back to the drawing board, pick a different vehicle, and possibly delay construction, or let it keep going. The state would finish building the airport around the hovercraft, and the borough could eventually use those same facilities for a helicopter in hopes of saving some money. And that's exactly what they decided to do. 3 years later, Rick Gifford, the borough administrator, says things have gone about as well as the assembly expected.
As it's turned out, the hovercraft cost three times more than $1 million. It cost over $3 million. They're just not willing to do that. They can't sustain it.
In February, the borough made the switch to the helicopter. It's going to cost $2 million a year, which is less than the hovercraft, but Gifford says still not cheap enough. So after a decade, the borough is looking once again for a permanent way to connect to the airport. Their only option now is a ferry. Gifford says it'll take at least 5 years and millions of dollars to set one up on a Coon.
A dock and a breakwater is not cheap. It's a major capital item up front, so it's going to take some money to get it started. But once those dollars are put in up front, then you'll reduce the annual operating cost to a point where it's feasible.
Sean Holland of the DOT says the state has money left over for the Accutane project. It could help pay for the dock, but Holland isn't sure if they could use it for the helicopter. And that's a problem for the borough. Administrator Rick Gifford says they're running out of money.
So unless we get some financial help from the state and the users, primarily Trident Seafoods, I just don't know how much long the borough will be willing to sustain that higher amount that it's costing them.
Ideally, he says the borough would split the cost of the helicopter with Trident and the state. Trident's processing plant in Accutane is the biggest in North America. They fly in thousands of workers every year, but they've already made contributions to the airport. As for the state, the legislature declined to pitch in last year. Gifford says the borough has about 6 months before they can't afford to run the helicopter anymore. It's not clear what that would mean for the 90 residents of Accutane Village. Mayor Joe Boreskin says they've been in limbo for a long time, and it's starting to feel like the norm.
Again, it's a revolving door that we have to go through until we get some sort of structure on at Goon for some sort of conventional vessel out there. It's just what we're faced with out here, and we'll do it as best our abilities.
There's not much else he can do. It's up to the Aleutians East Borough to bridge the gap for good. The only question now is if they'll have to do it on their own. In on Alaska, I'm Annie Ropeek.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Philip Manning in Talkeetna, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, Aaron Selbig in Homer, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Annie Ropeek in Accutane. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau and Liz Ruskin from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Crowley. Celebrating 60 years in Alaska, Crowley knows Alaska and uses that experience to deliver project solutions from concept to completion. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. First National Bank Alaska, who believes that success isn't simply having an idea, it is knowing the right lender to help bring it to life. More at FNBAlaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
And by
ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
If you're ready to quit tobacco or just thinking about it, the coaches at Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line, a free service for all Alaska adults, can support you with Text to Quit, with tools to make your quit attempt successful. Text to Quit helps you stay in touch with your quit coach, use nicotine replacement medications properly, manage those urges to use tobacco, and prevent relapses, all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.